This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Consuming Fire, The Interdependency, Book 2. Written by John Scalzi. Performed by Will Wheaton.
Prologue. Years later, Lenson Ornil would reflect on the irony that his time as a religious man would be bracketed by a single and particular word. "Well, fuck," Ganra Ornil said to her husband Tans on the bridge of their spaceship, the "We Never Agreed to This." Tans looked up from his own workstation, where he had been instructing their son Lenson, age 11, on some of the finer points of shipwide energy management.
"What is it?" he said.
"You know that Imperial ship that wasn't following us?"
"Yeah."
"It's following us now." Lenson watched his father frown, wipe the energy management screen from his own workstation, and call up the navigation screen. On the screen was a representation of all the ship traffic between the outpost of Kumasi and the flow shoal that would take the Agreed to Yogyakarta, their next destination, after 5 weeks of travel. Most of the ships were commercial and trade concerns like the Agreed. Two of them were Imperial Navy ships. One of those, the Oliver Brancid, had just plotted a course that would intercept the Agreed in roughly 6 hours, right before it hit the shoal.
"I thought we were paid up," Tans said to his wife.
"We are paid up," Ganra said. Tans motioned to his work screen as if to say, "Well, obviously not." Ganra shook her head.
"We're paid up," she repeated.
"There's a new naval commander," Gennaro Partridge, comms officer, said. She was part of the bridge crew of the Agreed. "I heard Sam here talking about it in mess. He says he was warned about him when we were loading in the cargo."
"You're telling us about this now?" Tans said to Partridge.
"Sorry, we were talking at mess. I thought Sam here told you."
"I meant to tell you," Samhir Gan, the ship's purser, said 3 minutes later when he appeared on the bridge in a hurry.
Lenson, looking at Gan's slightly breathless form, knew his father had a reputation for being a genial captain until he wasn't. Gan was in danger of making his father not genial.
"Sorry, we got busy in cargo."
"Tell me now," Tan said.
"The new naval commander is named Witt, a real grasping prick by all indications. Was transferred out of a job at Hub because he slept with the wrong person's spouse and is trying to get back there by cleaning house here, which means he's messing with established practices to look like he's being effective."
Tans frowned at this. Lenson, at 11, didn't know the particulars of his parents' business, but he knew enough to know that much of it was predicated on good relations with the various local and imperial law enforcement people of the systems the Agreed traveled to. This entailed established practices, which Lenson had only recently discovered, meant giving certain people money and other desirable things in ways that were understood to be not entirely legal. Lenson was neutral on all of this. He was young enough to believe that everything his parents did was, by definition, correct, and also to be bored with the fiddly details of their line of work. But it did seem like a long way to go around things.
"Who told you this?" Ganra asked Gan.
"Sibel Takat," Gan said, "my opposite on the Phenom." Lenson knew Gan was referring to the ship That's a Phenomenal View, with whom they had shared a cargo hold at the Kumasi Mercantile Station. Smaller ships, like the Agreed and the Phenom, would frequently co-rent cargo space on the station to save money. Occasionally during the load-in and load-out, things would get rushed and certain bits of inventory that started off on one ship would accidentally end up on another. Now that Lenson thought of it, he suspected this required some established practices as well.
"She mentioned that one of her payments got waived off by one of her usuals in the Navy here. He said he was being watched too closely by Witt's people now."
"We could have used this information sooner," Ganra said.
"Sorry," Gan repeated. "I meant to tell you. I thought Sibel was just talking about how graft was being cracked down on and we'd have to be less obvious about it from here on out. I didn't think she was saying that the Navy was going to be chasing us to the flow shoal."
Tans looked over to Partridge. "Any word from that naval ship?"
"They're not hailing us, no," Partridge said. "They're just moving to intercept."
"We're not at full power," Ganra said to her husband. "We could run for it."
Tan shook his head.
"Not yet. He tapped his work screen to signify the Brancid. That's a big ship, lots of mass. It's slower to accelerate, but faster under speed than we are. If we break and run now, they'll catch up to us before we make it to the shoal. If they catch us with this particular cargo, we're all fucked, Gon said, then remembered to whom he was asserting this fact. Sir. Tans nodded absentmindedly at this and danced his fingers across his workstation keyboard. Lenson looked and saw his father was making calculations for the Agreed and for the Brancid. He couldn't follow the details, but Tans made a small grunt of satisfaction and then looked up at him. Do you know what I'm doing? He asked Lenson. No, Lenson said. Guess. Trying to get away from the other ship. Right, Tans said. But do you know how? I already said if we accelerated now, they'd catch us. I don't know, Lenson said. Come on, work with me, Len. Lenson thought about it. You're waiting, he finally said, and hoped that his father wouldn't ask for any more detail than that because, frankly, Lenson had no idea what would come after that. Yes, Tans said. There's a point in time after which, if we accelerate under full engines, the Navy ship won't catch us before we make the flow shoal, even under their full power. And that time is, he looked over to Gonra, 4 hours, 16 minutes from now. As long as the Brancid doesn't start accelerating before then, Gonra said. Yes. And as long as our own engines are able to handle the load of full acceleration for the 3 hours it will take us to hit the shoal. Yes, and as long as our push fields stay active so we're not compressed into jelly by the constant high-G acceleration. Yes, Tan said testily. And as long as they don't try to shove a missile into our tailpipe. For fuck's sake, Gonra, Tan said. Let's not be too impressed with ourselves yet, is what I'm saying, Gonra concluded. She turned to her son. And you, go back to your cabin. The rest of us are going to be busy until we hit the shoal. There's nothing to do in my cabin, Lenson complained. Sure there is. It's called studying. Lenson groaned at this and trudged back to his cabin, which, despite being roughly the size of a broom closet, was the second most luxurious accommodation on the ship, after his parents' cabin, which was the size of 2 broom closets. In his cabin, Lenson activated his tablet and, rather than study, watched cartoons for a couple of hours until suddenly the cartoons wiped themselves out and educational materials appeared on his screen. Lenson groaned again, annoyed that his mother, who was supposed to be busy, had time to check on what he was looking at. Reluctantly, he started reading his religion lesson on Rakela, the prophet, first leader, and the first emperor of the interdependency. Lenson was not a very great student in a general sense, but found the religion lessons of his study particularly boring. Neither he nor his parents were in any way religious or followed the tenets of the Church of the Interdependency any more than they followed any other church. They weren't opposed to the church or any other religion. Lenson knew some of the crew members of the Agreed followed their own personal faiths, and his parents didn't care about it one way or the other. But the Ornils themselves left it alone, and had passed their rather neutral apathy on the matter to their son. The most you could say about the Ornil family's lack of religion was that when it came to which religion they weren't participating in, they weren't participating in the Church of the Interdependency most of all. For his part, Lenson knew other religions existed, but knew so little about them that it couldn't be said he rejected or ignored them. They weren't even on the table. The Church of the Interdependency, on the other hand, he knew at least a little about. One of the advantages of being the official religion of the Interdependency was that information about it was required reading in the study materials every child in the Empire was obliged to have as part of their education. You learned about the Sea of I and of the Prophet Emperor Rakela, whether you believed or not, and whether you cared or not. Well, that and the Ornils celebrated Emperor's Day, pinned to Rakela's standard calendar birthday like everyone did, as an excuse for sleeping in, trading gifts, and eating like a pig. Lenson's studies at the moment were not talking about Emperor's Day or gifts or stuffing oneself, unfortunately for him. They were discussing Rakela's prophecies, the set of future-seeing pronouncements that galvanized the disparate systems that housed human settlements into the single empire known as the Interdependency, and which helped to establish the economic, legal, and social systems that the Interdependency still worked from more than a millennium later. All of which, Lenson decided, were boring as heck. not only because the study materials crafted for readers between the standard ages of 10 and 12 did not go into the prophecies or their impact in any substantive manner, preferring simple declarative sentences that took the material as a pedagogical fact rather than a matter of interpretation and debate, which, to be fair, Lenson, again, not a very great student, would not have been an engaged participant in. It was also because of an inchoate feeling that Lenson had while reading about the prophecies, something that he couldn't have put into words even if he had tried. But had he tried, what they would have boiled down to would have been, hey, you know what? Basing an entire system of social, political, and economic control on the vague, all too easily misinterpreted words of a single person claiming divine inspiration is probably not actually all that smart now, is it? This was because Lenson, like his parents before him, was a mostly practical sort. Not personally given over to matters spiritual, teleological, or eschatological. And indeed, all of the above offered up a muted sense of disquiet. The intellectual version of biting into a piece of pie and having a taste there you can't quite pin down, but you know is not meant for that particular pie, and throws the whole thing off from being delicious to being a thing in your mouth that you're not entirely sure you want to be there, but it would be rude to spit it out, so you just swallow it, cover the rest of the pie with a napkin, and just try to get on with your day. Reading the prophecies gave Lenson this same maddeningly unpin-downable sense of intellectual dissatisfaction on top of his boredom. So he did the only logical thing he could about it. He fell asleep, tablet in hand. This was an excellent plan, until suddenly the Agreed rocked violently, spilling Lenson from his bunk, and a roaring wind tore through his cabin, sucking the air from it for several seconds until the cabin door slammed shut. Lenson lay on the floor, confused, gasping for breath, wondering what happened, and listening to several high-pitched whistling sounds in his cabin. His door had slammed shut, but the seal was not perfect. Likewise, while the air vents in his room had been sealed when air began rushing through them in the wrong direction, there were tiny places where air snuck around the seal. As a child who had lived on a spacecraft all his life, Lenson did not need to be told what those whistling sounds meant. He went to his door and pushed it completely shut, sealing it. That meant the only place his cabin was bleeding air was through the vents. The vent seals, unfortunately, were out of his reach, inside the walls of the ship. His tablet pinged, and Lenson answered it to find his mother on the other end. After the several seconds of weeping relief she had that her son was alive, she filled him in on what had happened. "Motherfucker shot at us," she said. And it was the first time Lenson had ever heard his mother use that particular profanity. "They couldn't catch up to us, and we weren't responding to their hails, so just before we entered the flow, they launched 3 missiles at us. Our defenses stopped them, but one detonated too close, and parts of the missile ruptured the hull near you. We've sealed off those areas, but we have a problem." "What is it?" Lenson asked. "We're in the flow now," Gonra said. "That means we have to be careful not to disturb the bubble of space-time around the ship. If we disturb it too much and we rupture it, that could mean trouble for the whole ship." Lenson knew his mother was underselling the danger. The flow was like a river that spaceships traveled between star systems, that could take the ships back and forth faster than if they traveled in normal space, where they could only go as fast as the speed of light. But while the flow was like a river, it wasn't a river. It was an extra-dimensional whatever it was that, if you were ever exposed to it directly, you would just disappear. Ships traveling in the flow had to make an energy bubble that trapped a bit of space-time with them so they could still exist inside the flow. And if the bubble popped, so did everything inside it. "So we just have to be careful on our way to you and in fixing the ship," Gonra said. "Mom, I'm losing air," Lenson said. Lenson watched his mother do a very good job of not losing it. "How much?" she asked. "Only a little now. I lost a lot at first, but then the door closed and I sealed it, but there's still air going out of the vent." Gonra turned away from her tablet for a moment to yell at someone on the bridge. Then she turned back to her son. "We're going to get that fixed first," she said, "and get some more air to you." "How long will that take?" Lenson asked. "Not long," Gonra promised. "Can you be brave until then?" "Sure," Lenson said. But after 2 hours and the air growing noticeably thinner, Lenson stopped being brave and began to cry a little. After 3 hours, he had a full-blown panic attack, and it took everything Tanz Ornil could do over the tablet connection to keep his son from hyperventilating away the dwindling supplies of his oxygen. After 4 hours, and for the first time in his life, Lenson prayed to the prophet Raikela. After 5 hours, she came to visit. Lenson looked up at the smiling visage of the prophet, who had a serene, calm smile that didn't quite reach her eyes, keeping in the best traditions of religious iconography through the ages, in which the gods, goddesses, and prophets could manage, at best, a disinterested upturning of the lips. Nevertheless, Lenson was quieted and warmed by it. "I'm scared," Lenson admitted to the prophet. She just smiled more at him, radiating comfort that was more reassuring than any words from her could be. It said to him, or so he believed, and in this particular moment, why should he doubt it, that she came because he prayed to her, that she came just for him, and that her presence here was proof that he, Lenson Ornil, would survive, and not just survive, but was destined for great things. It was there, lying quiet in his cabin, gazing up at the prophet, and blinking so very slowly that Lenson Ornil dedicated his life to the Church of the Interdependency. The prophet smiled down at him some more, as if accepting his gift of himself to her church. Just then, the vents clattered as they opened up, flooding the cabin with air. Lenson Ornil, gulping sweet oxygen and, in the throes of religious ecstasy, passed out. "That sounds like textbook hypoxia to me," Tanz Ornil told his son in the ship's small infirmary later that evening. Tanz had been the first to enter Lenson's cabin, his immediate terror assuaged when he heard his son snoring. When Lenson woke up in the infirmary, he had immediately told his parents of his miraculous visitor. "You were short of oxygen, and you'd been reading about the prophet just before the attack, so it makes sense you might hallucinate her." Lenson looked up at his father and his mother, both hovering over his infirmary cot, both so immensely relieved that their son was alive, and realized that they would never appreciate nor understand the experience of his visitation, and, rather maturely, he thought at the time, decided to let them off the hook, nodded in apparent agreement with his father, and then let them both change the subject to that bastard Wit, upon whom they vowed certain revenge, and who would, Lenson learned much later, somehow find himself on the wrong side of an airlock roughly a year after the Agreed was attacked. The rumor was that Wit had once again slept with the wrong someone else's spouse, but Lenson thought other factors might have been in play, which his parents may or may not have been involved with. By the time Lenson had finally heard about Wit's untimely encounter with the cold, dark vacuum of space, however, he was no longer on the Agreed. He was a student at the University of Xi'an Seminary School, the preeminent school for the Church of the Interdependency. Lenson's unconventional upbringing on a spaceship made him an object of some curiosity to his fellow seminarians, but only at first. What marked him further as an object of curiosity was his vision of the prophet. "Sounds like hypoxia," Ned Klee, one of his first-year flatmates, told him in a late-night bull session, taking a swig of Frotto, a mildly psychotropic liqueur, and passing it on to Lenson. "It wasn't hypoxia," Lenson said, taking the Frotto and passing it immediately to his right. "I mean, you were hypoxic, right?" Surah Jim, his other flatmate, said, taking the bottle. "Your ship had a gash in it, air was sucked out into space, your cabin was leaking air for hours." "Yes," Lenson admitted. "But I don't think that was why I saw her." "Pretty sure it was," Klee said. He reached across Lenson to take back the Frotto from Jim. "So neither of you ever had a vision of Raikela? Ever?" Lenson asked, discomfited. "Nope," said Klee. "I hallucinated a lizard once, but I was very high at the time." "It's not the same thing," Lenson said. "It's kind of the same thing," Klee said, and took another swig from the bottle. "A couple hits of this and I might see it again." Lenson decided that it probably wouldn't be a good thing to confide in his flatmates any more on this particular matter. Nor, as it would turn out, would he be confiding in most of his seminary mates. His fellow seminarians were generally kind, nice, moderate, and compassionate individuals, all of whom had a practical, realistic streak in them. None of whom had ever experienced an ecstatic religious fervor in their life, either for Raikela or for anyone else. The Church of the Interdependency is a largely practical religion, the Reverend Huna Prin, Lenson's curriculum advisor, told him in an early meeting when Lenson decided he needed guidance on the matter, and Prin seemed to him the one person obliged to address his issues without undue judgment. It doesn't really lend itself to mysticism, either in its tenets or its daily application. It's closer to something like Confucianism than Christianity in its root. But Rakella herself had visions, Lenson protested, holding up the paperback of Kowal's The Annotated Prophecies of Rakella I he'd happened to be carrying about and waving it at his advisor. Yes, she did, Prin agreed. And of course, one of the great discussions within the church is about the nature of those visions. Were they visions, actual communications with the divine, or visions? Lenson sensed the quotation marks around the word. Meant as parables to help a divided humanity understand the need for a new ethical system that focused on cooperation and interdependency on a much greater scale than ever existed before. Over the history of the church, these debates raged, Lenson said, nodding, echoing a primary text he'd read when he was much younger, imagining the brilliant early theologians going after each other in a high-stakes battle for the soul of the church. Well, raged is probably overstating it, Prin said. I think at the Fifth Ecclesiastical Diet, Bishop Chen threw a cup of tea at Bishop Gianni, but that was less about the fundamental nature of the visions than the fact Gianni kept interrupting Chen and she was sick of it. On the whole, the early debates were orderly and concerned about the practical issues of how to present the visions. The early bishops were well aware that charismatic religions have a tendency to breed schisms and divisions, which is against the fundamental concept of interdependency. Surely there are others who have had visions like mine, Lenson said to Prin, and in later memories of the conversation, he remembered the pleading nature of the question to his advisor. The history of the church records occasional priests and bishops who claimed religious visions and used them as justification for attempted schisms, Prin allowed. The church has an inquiry process for it, which any priest or bishop who claims the visions must undergo. What happens? If I recall correctly, usually the priests claiming visions are referred to medical attention, for previously undiagnosed mental health issues, treated and returned to service, or retired if the issues persist. Lenson frowned. So the church declares them crazy. Crazy is a loaded term. I think it's better said that the church realizes, as a practical matter, that visions usually aren't actually divinely inspired, but the result of other, less dramatic phenomena. Better to address that than to let the condition persist and possibly risk a schism. But I had a vision, and my mental health is fine. Prin shrugged. Sounds like hypoxia to me. Lenson brushed this aside. What happens if an emperor claims to have visions, he asked. They're the actual head of the church. Do they go up against an inquiry? I don't know, Prin admitted. It hasn't happened since Rakella. Never, Lenson said skeptically. After their investiture, the emperors don't tend to bother with the church much, Prin said. They have other things to worry about, and so do you, Lenson. So you think I should just chalk up my vision to lack of oxygen? I think you should view your vision as a gift, Prin said, holding up her hand to calm her advisee. However it came to you, it inspired you to a life of service in the church, and that's a blessing to you, and has the potential to be a blessing to the church. It's already been life-changing to you, Lenson. Are you happy with the path it's put you on? Yes, Lenson said, meaning it. Then there you are, Prin said. In that sense, it doesn't matter whether it was divinely inspired or the result of a temporary lack of oxygen. What matters is that, in the aftermath, and while you did have enough oxygen, you decided to make the church your vocation. So, let's you and I make the most of that, shall we? Lenson decided to make the most of it and plunged into his seminary studies. Some of his early elective classes delved into the mysticism of the Church of the Interdependency, but ironically, they were taught in a dry and unengaging style. The church's approach to what otherwise might be forbidden or apostate writings was not to avoid them, but to smother the romance out of them with volumes of commentary apparently designed to put the reader to sleep. Lenson read all he could stand and found his interest draining away, slowly at first and more rapidly as time went on. Two things were happening to Lenson. The first was, simply, that the day-to-day needs of his seminary and pastoral education were taking an upper hand. The amount of time and interest he could give over to the more esoteric aspects of the church, as little as that eventually turned out to be, was shrinking as he managed the more prosaic topics of service and community engagement and did his time in Xi'an and Hub, watching and helping priests and church lay employees tend to their duties, duties that he would one day assume. It was more difficult to stay engaged with the esoterica of one's religion when one was helping stock candles for services. The second was that Lenson's own fundamental practical nature, passed down to him from his parents through nature and nurture and never fully tamped down, even at the height of his religious conversion, slowly and surely reasserted itself, aided rather than dissuaded by the Church of the Interdependency's mundane aspects. Lenson found that the routine and quiet systems of control the church offered appealed to him, and that he moved well within them. Over the course of his years at the seminary, he transformed himself in the eyes of his professors and fellow students from an object of curiosity to a model seminarian, one who was marked for his potential for an upward path in the church. Lenson let himself be carried along in this wave of approbation and affection. In his first postings after his ordination to Bremen, where his parents, after carefully waiting out certain statutes of limitations, had retired comfortably. And then to his later postings back at Hub, and eventually to Xi'an itself, where, in the fullness of time, he was made a bishop, with a portfolio for maintaining church services to the poorest of the citizens of the interdependency, a post that put a premium on the practical rather than the purely spiritual side of the church. As Lenson, now bishop or nil, moved further up and deeper into the Church of the Interdependency, the more the instigating event of his joining the church, the vision of the prophet Ray Kella, was demoted in his memory. From a galvanizing moment of conversion, it eventually became a quiet source of faith, then an odd event that had led to a life choice, then a story for close friends in the church, then an anecdote for parishioners, and finally, a punchline at cocktail parties, where it was dutifully trotted out for new acquaintances when another bishop asked him to recount it. "It sounds like a beautiful moment," one young woman said to him at such a party. "It was probably hypoxia," he replied in a charmingly deprecating manner. In some small corner of his mind, Lenson was aware that it was a shame that his sole moment of religious ecstasy had over time been rationalized down to the residue of a malfunctioning metabolic process by himself no less than by others. But his response to that small corner was, he thought, a good one, that in place of one misattributed moment of mysticism, he had accrued a lifetime of practical service in a church that served as one of the cornerstones of the most successful and in many ways the most enduring of all human civilizations. The cynical would say that the church, so well integrated as it was into the imperial system, was just another lever of control. But Lenson was also aware that the cynical could afford the luxury of their cynicism because of the stability of the system they mocked. In short, there was almost nothing mystical about Lenson's religion, or in these later days, to his faith. But it did not mean his faith was lessened. In fact, his faith was stronger than it ever was. But it was not faith in the prophet Ray Kella. It was faith in the church that sprang from her. A practical church, designed to endure through centuries and to help the empire that grew up with it endure as well. He believed in the Church of the Interdependency, and its mission, and his mission, within the warm and solid and fundamentally mundane confines of its rule. He was at peace with his practical faith. It was this Bishop Lenson or nil who, with all the other bishops of the Church of the Interdependency as could be assembled within the allotted time, sat in the pews of Xi'an Cathedral, awaiting Emperor Greyland II, the titular head of the Church of the Interdependency, who had, unusually, decided to address the principles of her church as the cardinal of Xi'an and Hub, which is to say as the actual head of the Church of the Interdependency, rather than in her more prosaic guise of Empero. This raised eyebrows, since no other Empero in living memory had chosen to do so. The last who had, Arendt III, had done so over 300 standard years previously, and it had been on the rather dry subject of the redrawing of ecclesiastical districting, so bishoprics were better apportioned by population. Current dioceses were perfectly acceptable from a population point of view. It wouldn't be on that. Likewise, Greyland II, while considered pleasantly ineffectual by the bishops in her role as Empero, had not to this point shown any particular affinity for the church as an entity. She had recently been preoccupied with an attempted rebellion by the Nahumapetan family and a theoretical issue regarding the stability of the flow streams around the interdependency, neither of which was directly related to the church, its processes, or mission. The idea that the emperor would wish to address the bishops on an ecclesiastical matter was surprising, and some would even say, perhaps cheeky. The general feeling of the bishops assembled was that they were willing to listen tolerantly to whatever musings their young emperor might have, and then go to the formal reception with her afterward, have some nibbles and a photograph with her, and then always have the event as a curious memory and conversation piece. Certainly, Lenson thought this was the way it would go. Thus was Bishop Lenson Ornil, and, to be fair, the rest of the bishops of the church, caught unawares when Greyland II, in the simple vestments of an ordinary priest rather than her cardinal finery, stood at the edge of the chancel and began by saying, "Many years ago, our ancestor and predecessor Raquel had visions. Those miraculous visions brought about our church, this foundation upon which rests our entire civilization. Brothers and sisters, we have good news. We, too, have had visions, wonderful visions, miraculous visions, visions which speak to the mission of our church and its role in the turbulent times of which we stand at the precipice. Rejoice, brothers and sisters. Our church is called to a new spiritual awakening for the salvation of humanity in this world and beyond it." Lenson Ornil took in Greyland II's words, their intent and meaning, what they boded for the church as he understood it, his faith as he had developed it, and the genesis of his engagement with both, trapped in that small cabin, struggling to breathe, all those many long years ago. And then, quite without meaning to, he uttered the words to encapsulate what he was feeling about each in this one epical moment. "Well, fuck," he said. Book 1, Chapter 1. In the beginning was the lie. The lie was that the prophet Raquel, the founder of the Holy Empire of Interdependent States and Mercantile Guilds, had mystical visions. These visions prophesied both the creation and the necessity of that far-reaching empire of human settlements, strung out across light years of space, connected only by the flow, the metacosmological structure that humans compared to a river. They thought of it as a river mostly because human brains, originally designed for hauling their asses across the African savanna and not much upgraded since then, literally could not comprehend what it actually was. So fine. River it was. There was no mystical element involved in the so-called prophecies of Raquel at all. The Wu family ginned them up. The Wus, who owned and ran a consortium of businesses, some that built starships and others that hired out mercenaries, looked at the then-current political climate and decided the time was right to make a play for control of the flow shoals. The places where humanly understandable space-time connected with the flow and allowed spaceships to enter and exit that metaphorical river between the stars. The Wus understood well that creating tolls and monopolizing their extraction was a much more stable business model than building things or blowing them up, depending on which of the Wus' businesses one contracted. All they needed to do was to create a reasonable justification to make themselves the toll collectors. In the meetings of the Wus, the prophecies were proposed, accepted, written, structured, A-B tested, and honed before they were attached to Raquel Wu, a young scion of the family who was already well known as the public charitable face of the Wu family, and who also had a razor-sharp mind for marketing and publicity. The prophecies were a family project. Well, the project of certain important members of the family. You wouldn't let just anyone in on it. Too many cousins were indiscreet and good only for drinking and being regional executives. But it was Raquella who sold them. Sold them to whom? To the public at large, who needed to be convinced of the concept of the far-flung and disparate human settlements coming together under a single, unified governmental umbrella, incidentally to be headed by the Wus, who, as it happened, would collect levies on interstellar travel. Not just Raquella, to be sure. In each star system, the Wus hired and bribed local politicians and publicly acceptable intelligentsia to promote the idea from a political and social point of view, to the sort of people who would like to imagine they needed a cogent and logical reason to toss away local sovereignty and control to a nascent political union that was already being constructed on imperial lines. But for the ones who either weren't that intellectually vain, or simply preferred to get the idea of an interdependent union from an attractive young woman whose non-threatening message of unity and peace just made them feel good, well, here was the newly dubbed Prophet Raquella. The Wus didn't bother selling the mystical idea of the interdependency to the other families and large corporations that they and their conglomerate moved among. For those, they took another tack instead. Support the Wus' plan for rent-seeking disguised as an altruistic exercise for nation-building, and in return get a monopoly on a specific durable good or service. In effect, trade their current businesses with their annoyingly spiky boom and bust cycles for a stable, predictable, and ceaseless income stream for all time. Plus, a discount on the tolls the Wus were about to enact on flow travel. In point of fact, these weren't discounts at all, because the Wus were planning to charge for a thing that used to be without cost to anyone. But the Wus assumed that these families and companies would be so dazzled by the offer of an unassailable monopoly that they wouldn't kick, which turned out to be mostly correct. In the end, it took the Wus less time than they expected to pull off their interdependency scheme. Within 10 years, the other families and companies were in line with their monopolies and promised noble titles. The paid-for politicians and intellectuals made their case, and the prophet Raquella and her rapidly expanding interdependent church mopped up most of the rest of the public. There were holdouts and stragglers and rebellions that would go on for decades, but by and large, the Wus had correctly picked their time, their moment, and their goal. And for the troublemakers, they had already decided that the planet called End, the human outpost in the newly imagined interdependency that took the longest to get to and to get back from, and had only a single flow shoal in and out, would be the official dumping ground for anyone who got in their way. Raquella, already the public and spiritual face of the interdependency, was selected by carefully orchestrated acclamation as the first empero. This new gender-neutral title had been chosen because market testing showed that it appealed to nearly all market segments as a fresh, new, and friendly spin on emperor. This compact and highly elided history of the formation of the interdependency may make it appear as if no one questioned the lie, that billions of people uncritically swallowed the fiction of Raquella's prophecies. This was not at all accurate. People did question the lie, to the same amount as they would question any bit of pop spirituality marching toward an actual religion, and became alarmed as it gained acceptance and followers and respectability. Nor were observers of the time blind to the machinations of the Wu family as it made its play for imperial power. It was the focus of many hand-wringing editorials, news shows, and occasionally attempted legislative action. What the Wu family had over them was organization and money, and allies in the form of the other now noble families. The formation of the Holy Empire of the Interdependent States and Mercantile Guilds was a charging musk ox, and the skeptical observers were a cloud of gnats. Neither did much damage to the other, and in the end, there was an empire.
One other reason the lie worked is that once the interdependency formed, the prophet Emperor Rekella declared her visions and prophecies had largely come to an end for now. She devolved all functional power in the administration of the interdependent church to the Archbishop of Xi'an and a committee of bishops, who knew a good deal when they saw one. They rapidly built an organization that shoved the explicitly spiritual aspect of the church to the side to be the spice of the new religion, not its main course. In other words, neither Rekella nor the church overplayed its spiritual hand in the critical early years of the interdependency, when the empire was necessarily at its most fragile. Rekella's imperial successors, none of whom added the prophet part of the title to their address, largely followed her example, staying out of church business except for the most ceremonial parts, both to the relief, and then as the centuries passed to the expectation, of the church itself. The lie of Rekella's visions and prophecy was never acknowledged by the church, of course. Why should it have been? To begin, neither Rekella nor the Wu family ever explicitly said, outside of family conferences, that the spiritual side of the interdependent church was wholly concocted. One could not expect Rekella's successors, either as emperor or in the church, to own up to it, or even to publicly air their own suspicions and undermine their own authority. After that, it was simply a matter of waiting until the visions and prophecy became doctrine. For another thing, Rekella's visions and prophecies largely came true. This was a testament to the fact that the prophecy of the interdependency, while expansive, was also practically achievable if one had ambition, money, and a certain amount of ruthlessness, all of which the Wu family had in bulk. Rekella's prophecies did not ask people to change the way they lived in the small bore everyday sense. It just asked them to swap out their system of governance so that those at the very, very top could have even more power, control, and money than they had before. As it turned out, this was not too much to ask. Finally, as it happened, the Wu family wasn't wrong. Humanity was widely dispersed. And of all the star systems that the flow was known to touch, only one of them had a planet capable of sustaining human life in the open. End. All the humans in all the other systems lived in habitats, on planets, moons, or floating in space, all monstrously vulnerable in their isolation, none of them entirely able to produce the raw materials needed for their existence or to manufacture all they would need to survive. Humanity needed interdependence to survive. Whether it needed the interdependency as the political, social, and religious structure to implement that interdependence was highly questionable, but a millennium on, a moot point. The Wu family had envisioned a path to long-term, sustainable political and social power for itself and took it, using a lie as a tool to get everybody else to go along. Incidentally, the Wus also created a system under which most humans could have a comfortable life without the existential fear of isolation, entropy, the inevitable horrifying collapse of society, and the death of everyone and everything they hold dear hanging over their heads every moment of every day. The lie worked out for everyone, more or less. It was awesome for the Wus, pretty great for the rest of the noble class, and generally perfectly okay for most other folks. When a lie has negative consequences, people dislike it. But otherwise, they move on, and eventually the lie as a lie is forgotten, or in this case, codified as the foundation of religious practice and buffed and sanded into something prettier and more congenial. The visions and prophecies of Rekella were a lie, which functioned exactly as intended, which meant that visions and prophecy remained a doctrinal cornerstone of the interdependent church, from a prophet. Mind you. There had been one who had become the first emperor. There was nothing in church doctrine barring another emperor from claiming the power of vision or prophecy. Indeed, church doctrine deeply suggested that as the head of the interdependent church, the visionary power of prophecy was the birthright of the successor emperors, all 87 of whom to date could trace their lineage back to the prophet emperor Rekella herself. Who, aside from being the mother of the interdependency, was also the mother of 7 children, including triplets. Every emperor was doctrinally capable of having visions and making prophecies.
It's just that, excepting Raquella herself, none of them ever did. None, that is, until now. In the anteroom of the Chamber of the Executive Committee, the room given over at the Imperial Palace to the group of the same name, and of which she was the chair, Archbishop Gunda Corbane abruptly paused, surprising her assistant, and bowed her head. "Your Eminence?" her assistant, a young priest named Ubes Isi, said. Corbane held up her hand to quell the question, and stood there for a moment, collecting her thoughts.
"This used to be easier," she said under her breath.
Then she smiled ruefully. She had intended to offer up a small prayer, one for patience and calm and serenity, in the face of what was likely to be a long day and month, and possibly rest of her career. But what came out was something else entirely.
"Well, and that was about par for the course these days, wasn't it? Did you say something, Your Eminence?"
Isi asked.
"Only to myself, Ubes," Corbane said.
The young priest nodded to this, and then pointed to the door of the chamber. "The other members of the executive committee are already here. Minus the Emperor, of course. She'll be arriving at the agreed time."
"Thank you," Corbane said, looking at the door.
"Everything all right?" Isi asked, following his boss's gaze. Isi was deferential, but he wasn't stupid, Corbane knew. He was well aware of recent events. He couldn't have missed them. No one could have. They had rocked the church.
"I'm fine," Corbane assured him.
She moved toward the door and Isi moved with her, but Corbane held up her hand again.
"No one in this meeting but committee members," she said,
and then caught the unasked question on Isi's face.
"This meeting is likely to have a frank exchange of views, and it's best those are kept in the chamber."
"A frank exchange of views?" Isi repeated skeptically.
"Yes," Corbane said. "That's the euphemism I'm going with at the moment."
Isi frowned, then bowed and stepped aside. Corbane looked up, offered a prayer, for real this time, and then pushed through the doors into the chamber. The chamber was large and excessively ornate in a way that only a room in an imperial palace could be, filled with the cruft of centuries of artistic gifts, patronage, and acquisitions by emperors with more money than taste. Along the far wall of the chamber, a mural flowed, representing some of the great historical figures that had been part of the executive committee over the centuries. It was painted by the artist Lambert, who had painted the background in the style of the Italian Renaissance, and the figures themselves in early interdependency realism. From her earliest days on the committee, Corbane had found the mural both an appalling mishmash and its heroic representation of figures an almost hilarious overrepresentation of the importance of the executive committee and what it did on a day-to-day basis.
"No one's going to put this committee in a mural," Corbane thought,
approaching the long table that featured 10 ornate chairs. 8 of those chairs were already filled with the 2 other representatives of the church, 3 members of parliament, and 3 members representing the guilds and the nobility who controlled them. One of the remaining chairs, at one end of the table, was for her, as head of the committee. The other was for the Emperor, currently Greyland II, the source of Corbane's current headache. As she was reminded the very second she sat down in her seat.
"What the fuck is this about the Emperor having visions?" said Taryn Asan, scion of the House of Asan and the newest member of the committee. He was a hasty, probably too hasty in Corbane's estimation, replacement for Nadashe Nohama Peton, who was currently in imperial custody for murder, treason, and the attempted assassination of the Emperor. Corbane missed her relatively polite presence. Nadashe may have been a traitor, but she had decent manners. Asan's current outburst was, alas, standard operating procedure for him. He was one of those people who believed social graces were for the weak. Corbane looked around the table to see the other reactions to this outburst, which ranged from disgust to weary recognition that Asan's behavior probably was setting new, low benchmarks for bad behavior.
"And a good morning to you too, Lord Taryn," Corbain said. How good of you to start our meeting off with a round of pleasantries.
You want pleasantries while our Emperor announces that she's having religious delusions about the end of the interdependency and the destruction of the guild system, Asan said. May I suggest, Your Eminence, that your sense of priorities is out of whack.
Insulting the other members of the committee is not a very effective way to work, Lord Terran, said Yupeksha Ranatunga, the ranking parliamentarian on the committee. Asan had been rubbing Ranatunga the wrong way from the moment he joined the committee. This took some effort, Corbain knew. Ranatunga was the very model of the practical politician. She made it her business to get along with everybody, especially the people she loathed.
Let me offer a rebuttal, Asan said. In the past month, our beloved Emperor has announced that she believes the flow, our way to travel between stars, is collapsing, and trotted out some backwater scientist no one's heard of to bolster her claim. This claim is fueling economic and social unrest, even as other scientists dispute the assertion. And now, in response to that, the Emperor is claiming mystical communications. But Her Eminence here, Asan waved at Corbain, wants to exchange pleasantries. Fine. Hello, Your Eminence. You are looking very well. Also, wasting time on pleasantries is stupid and unnecessary. And incidentally, in case you haven't heard, the leader of the Empire is having fucking visions. So maybe we should dispense with the pleasantries and focus on that. What do you say?
And what is your objection to these visions, Lord Terran?
Corbain said, as pleasantly as possible, folding her hands together.
Are you kidding? Asan leaned forward in his chair. One, it's obvious that the Emperor's claiming visions because she's getting pushback on the idea that the flow is shutting down. She's trying to do an end run around Parliament and the guilds which are resisting her. Two, so far, the Church, your end of things, Your Eminence, is giving her cover to do just that. Three, if she is having visions and isn't just using them as a convenient lever, then our young new Emperor is in fact delusional, and that just might be a pressing issue. All of these need to be addressed now.
The Church isn't giving the Emperor cover, said Bishop Chant Bordelion, who, as the second most junior member of the committee, sat across from Asan.
Really? Asan shot back. I haven't heard a peep out of the Church about it since Greyland gave her little speech in the cathedral 2 days ago. That's just a few news cycles. You surely could have said something about it by now. A rebuttal, perhaps?
The Emperor is head of the Church, Bordelion said, in a tone that suggested he was instructing a particularly stubborn child. This isn't some minor priest going rogue in a far-flung mining habitat who we can tell to get in line.
So it's different for Emperors, Asan cracked sarcastically.
In fact, it is, Corbain said. The Emperor addressed the bishops formally, speaking ex cathedra, not in her capacity as the secular head of the Empire, but in her ecclesiastical person as the successor to the Prophet. We can't dismiss what she said in that context, nor can we rebut it. The most we in the Church can do is work with it, interpret it.
Interpret delusions.
Interpret visions.
Corbain looked around the table.
The Interdependent Church was founded through the visions of the Prophet Rekella, who also became the first Emperor of the Interdependency. The roles have been intertwined since the founding of the Empire.
She focused on Asan.
Doctrinally speaking, Greyland is doing nothing controversial. The Church, whatever its current nature, was founded on visions of a spiritual nature. Our doctrine accepts that the Cardinal of Xian and Hub, as the head of the Church, may have visions of a spiritual nature, just as Rekella did, and that these visions may be revelatory and may affect doctrine.
And you expect us to go along with that, Asan said.
Who is the us you are referring to,
Corbain asked. The guilds for one, Asan pointed to Ranatunga. Parliament for another. There are still laws for blasphemy, Bord Leon noted. They're even occasionally enforced. Well, isn't that convenient, Asan said. Lord Terran has a point, Ranatunga said, and Corbain, for one, respected Ranatunga for being able to say that without stroking out. Doctrinally correct or not, no emperor in memory has so actively laid claim to the religious mantle of head of the church. Certainly none have claimed visions.
You believe the timing is suspicious,
Corbain said to Ranatunga. Suspicious is not the word I would use, Ranatunga replied, politic as ever. But I'm not blind to Greyland's political situation either. Lord Terran is correct. She's disrupted the function of the government with her claims about the flow. She's panicking people. The answer to this is not to appeal to prophecy, but to science and reason. Corbain frowned slightly at this. Ranatunga caught it and held out a placating hand. This is not a criticism of the church or its doctrines, she said. But, Gunda, you have to admit it. This is not what emperors do. We need, at the very least, to ask her about it directly. A notification on Corbain's tablet pinged. She read it and stood, prompting the others to stand as well.
You're about to have your chance up. She's here.
Chapter 2. The moment Emperor Greyland II had been waiting for came at the end of a long and frankly mind-numbing meeting.
Your Majesty, perhaps we should further discuss your visions, Archbishop Gunda Corbain said.
Around the table, the heads of the executive committee, tasked with advising the Emperor in her administration of the interdependency, whether she wanted that advice or not, swiveled to look at her. On those nine faces, Greyland registered various emotions. Some registered concern, which she appreciated. Some registered contempt, which she did not. Others registered, variously, amusement, irritation, disgust, or confusion. Some faces registered some or all of these emotions combined. Greyland II, Emperor of the Holy Empire of the Interdependent States and Mercantile Guilds, Queen of Hub and Associated Nations, Head of the Interdependent Church, Successor to Earth and Mother to All, 88th Emperor of the House of Wu, studied all these faces, taking in the expressions arrayed across the table, assessing the emotions of the nine arguably most powerful people in the known universe aside from her, and then laughed, which did not endear her further to them.
You think us mad, Greyland said, employing the imperial we, because in point of fact, she was busy being the emperor at the moment and could use the imperial address without undue pretension. No one has suggested such a thing, Corbain said hastily.
We are very sure that is not true, Greyland replied lightly. Certainly no one has suggested such a thing here at this table to our face, but we are not so naive as to believe that away from our presence, such things are not only whispered, but spoken aloud, and perhaps occasionally shouted. At this, Greyland noticed several sets of eyes shift to Terran Asan, the newest member of the committee. This did not exactly surprise her.
We are all loyal, Your Majesty, Upeksha Ranatunga said.
Greyland turned to Ranatunga.
We have no reason to doubt the committee's loyalty, she said, kindly.
Ranatunga was the one who had a concerned expression. To me, and to the interdependency. Yet we are also aware where loyalty can drive the concerned, if they believe the person to whom they are loyal has taken leave of their senses. Your Majesty wishes our obedience, then, said Asan. He'd been one with contempt on his face, although, to be fair, he'd worn that expression since he'd taken his seat a few weeks prior.
We are hoping for your faith, Greyland said, and looked around the table.
You may believe we understand that this faith is difficult for you. No emperor since Raykella has claimed revelatory visions until now.
For a millennium, the Emperors have been content to stay out of the revelation business, and even those of us who experienced delusions kept them out of the religious sphere. When Ottavio II experienced alcoholic hallucinations near the end of his reign, he saw bejeweled chickens running around the palace. Greyland chuckled at this and then noted that no one else at the table was chuckling with her. "Some of us worry your visions may be closer to chickens than actual revelation," Asan said. And Greyland watched as 8 pairs of eyebrows, attached